Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back from lunch. You're here for the session today, underwriting on direct life products for the new world. Just check that's right for everyone. No one's leaving. That's good. Just like to introduce my two speakers here to my right. We've got Elizabeth Baker. Elizabeth is a director at EY, more than 25 years' experience in financial services in Australia, Europe, and Asia. She's held several chief actuary and appointed actuary roles and has extensive operational experience in a broad range of life insurance areas, including product and pricing, claims management, underwriting, financial, capital, risk management, etc. And then we've got Meera Sadana. Meera is a manager at EY with over 6 years' experience in financial services industry in Australia. She's been involved in product development and pricing for a number of Australian life insurers and reinsurers. In addition, she's focused on claims management, capital management, and risk management projects for various insurers. If you'd like to welcome the speakers.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for choosing our presentation. I know you've got quite a lot of things, other choices that you could make. Can I have a show of hands who's working in the life insurance space or the reinsurance space? Pretty much everyone. That's good. Okay. So I think the genesis of our presentation was last year when I did a number of claims reviews, and you could see some of the cases coming out for declined claims was about product complexity. And then you looked at the personal statement, especially for direct, and you looked at those, and they were very, very complicated, and you thought, wow, there must be a better way of doing things. So, and then speaking to other people in the industry, and I know a number of insurers and reinsurers are looking at more behavioural economics and other concepts. So that was the genesis of our presentation. So, so what we're going to talk about today is a bit of background, and then Meera's going to talk about what we'd like to see, the desired outcomes from direct life underwriting, from two points of view, really, from the customer and from the insurer's point of view. And we think in a lot of cases, we just think about the insurer. We don't really think necessarily about the customer experience, and it's time to think more a lot about the customer. And we're going to look at we're going to show you some examples of some questions that you can see right now in the market for products and other things. And Meera's going to do that, and then I'm going to come back and talk about some opportunities for improvement and how we could possibly move direct life underwriting, including the personal statement, into the 21st century. I mean, if you look at what we as the industry are doing, it's quite a throwback to the, you know, sometimes the 80s, and things haven't moved on in a lot of cases since then. So what we're going to do, what we'd like to do, is redesign direct life underwriting with, as I said, to improve the customer experience. But you need to make financially sound decisions. No one's suggesting that we don't need underwriting. We just think we need to do it in a better way. If you look at the products here, but it has, you could apply it to a lot of things, but products are typically there for death. They include terminal illness. You might have critical illness or trauma. You might have disability, TPD and IP. Sums assured are lower relative to that of retail business. So you might get $1 million, but in a lot of cases you get a lot less than that. And typically there are no medical tests and product exclusions often apply. And the form of underwriting is the personal statement. So if you look, our observations are there's an increasing proportion of tele-underwriting, but it's based on the form. It starts off with the personal statement form. And people tell us that there's actually better disclosure by customers in tele-underwriting when someone actually speaks to the customer. However, it's not clear why that is just quite yet. There's a lot of reinsurers providing underwriting rules engines. And so the technology is becoming a lot more sophisticated, but what companies are actually putting in it is not that sophisticated. Still, we'll get to that. There's many, many, I don't know, who's actually familiar with the personal statement of your company's product? Has anyone applied lately for a product? Okay. So one of the calls to action is you might want to go and have a look at some of these products out in the market. We had our graduates who are about, you know, straight out of university, they're 23, they just thought it was from the ARC, you know, like some of these things. So it's quite surprising some of the things that we as the industry are doing. And there's not a lot of change. You can't see a lot of change over time from the underwriting questions. So if you look at banking, general insurance, health insurance and life insurance, and if you look at the value chain, so if you think about the concepts, at the start there's sort of new business application underwriting, then there's the product itself, and then there's the claims and servicing. Well, certainly in life insurance, there's very limited innovation in the product itself. It's all the benefit categories are very standard, you know, death, terminal illness, critical illness. There was a presentation before lunch about trauma. Even that hasn't moved on that much, and that's really the latest new benefit that we've created. So there's pretty limited innovation in the product, so in the middle, but you can see some examples in other industries, especially in general insurance. So someone like a Trove or a Cover, that it's basically flexible general insurance, more modular. There's a lot of there's more innovation at the front end in life insurance, so around the application process itself, and there's more focus on the customer in terms of claims management and also servicing of the customer. So the technology is getting better, but what we are applying to the technology is really the same old thing. So I think it's the time is to use that new technology to apply better concepts with a better outcome for the customer. So this is just our view, not really scientific. It's just based on examples that we see. And the FSC Life Code, it's, we would say, the burning platform. It comes in very soon. It comes in on the 1st of July. So you need to now really evidence to the customer how you've made these underwriting decisions. And you're going to have to provide, in theory, a lot more evidence. And you have to... The fourth one's interesting. You have to regularly review and monitor electronic underwriting to ensure the questions are consistent and then they're relevant. And we'll show you some examples, but I think a lot of the things we're asking now, you would question whether they're really relevant to the risks that we're rating. So there's the code. And then last year there was the ASIC 498 report, and we picked out a case study. Not sure if it's from Direct or not sure the company, but it doesn't really matter. There's things in this industry that are, we probably shouldn't be very proud of when you look at the customer. So here's a case where the customer had cancer, and then the company is trying to avoid the policy on the basis of non-disclosure of a minor depression, which has nothing to do with the cancer. So if you're the customer, and you can see other cases like this if you looked in other parts of the industry, and partly it's because our product is very complicated, and our personal statements are not that easy for the customer to understand what they should be disclosing, what they're not disclosing. So we would say there's a lot of push and reasons why we should be moving. So what we've done a market analysis. We've looked at a number of products. We've looked at the report 498. We did some mystery shopping, and we applied for some policies online ourselves. So me personally, I applied for one policy online. I declined. I mean, I disclosed one minor condition, and I was rejected, and I was given accidental death cover, and that was what I got, which I know that's not probably very suitable for me, but would an average customer know that? So we've got all the process, but as soon as you answer yes to any question, you're basically out online. So that's probably not what we really want. We've done quite a few interviews with various stakeholders, CMOs, reinsurers, underwriters, and some technology providers. And then we've come up with some opportunities for redesign based on that. So Mira's going to show you our study from our current state assessment.
Thanks, Liz. So prior to performing our market analysis and stakeholder interviews, Liz and I set out to determine what are the desired outcomes of direct life underwriting. In direct life underwriting, there are two key parties, the customer and the insurer. Historically, much of the focus of direct life underwriting tends to be on meeting the objectives of the insurer. Following the introduction of the FSC Life Insurance Code of Practice, we need to start to prioritise the customer and think about the desired outcomes of direct life underwriting from their point of view. For a customer, the desired outcome of direct life underwriting is timely, fair and transparent underwriting. Customers want clearer setting of expectations at the outset of their policy. They want to understand what their duty of disclosure is to the insurer, whether or not they're covered for a particular product, what their product covers, and if there are any pre-existing condition exclusions that apply, over what period these would apply. Additionally, customers want to develop a relationship with trust with their insurer. They want to know that their insurer will be there for them in their time of need. We know for direct life products that there's no advisor managing the relationship between the customer and the insurer. In addition, there are only a few interactions between the customer and the insurer. As a result, the underwriting stage is a key time at which for the company to develop both trust and loyalty with their customer by way of a positive underwriting experience. In comparison, for the insurer, the desired outcome of direct life underwriting is to effectively manage risk. Companies want to make financially sound and evidence-based decisions on what lives they'll accept and on what terms. Additionally, companies want to enable their underwriting staff and claims management staff to make the right decisions. On speaking to a number of industry practitioners, it became evident to us that the underwriting, sales and distribution, claims management and product and pricing teams have very different and at times competing objectives. To ensure then that a direct life product is within a company's risk appetite, it's sustainable in the long term and it's financially sound, we need to ensure that we have a clear and continuous link between each of these functions. We need to start to ask ourselves, firstly, how much risk are we willing to take on? Based on this level of risk, how many questions should we ask and how much cover are we willing to provide? And finally, how much will it cost? We know that the product design and underwriting decisions that we make will drive an insurer's claims experience. As a result, any issues that we see in the claims experience should be investigated and used to refine both the product design and the underwriting questions that we ask. As Liz mentioned previously, as part of our analysis, we put ourselves in the shoes of the customer and set out to apply for direct life products online. Here are some of our observations on the current state of underwriting questions. It's worth noting that these are observations taken from across the industry and don't relate to any single insurer. Firstly, we were surprised by the large volume of questions that are asked, often as many as 30 to 45 questions with multiple parts. These questions are quite text-heavy, will often contain medical jargon, and there's no option to complete these in any language other than English. The questions are not always targeted by product. So regardless of whether you're applying for death cover or income protection cover, you may be asked the full set of 30 to 45 questions rather than those that are relevant to the product of interest. The questions are not always set out in order of importance. So to give you an example, for disability products, we know that some of the top causes of claim are major depression and musculoskeletal issues. Yet these questions didn't place near the top of the list of overall questions. While it's fair to say that the underwriting questions have changed over time, they are still largely disease-driven with a focus on diagnosis. There is limited use of biopsychosocial questions and behavioural economics. We know, however, that each individual will respond differently to a given impairment. This will depend on a number of factors, from behavioural factors to social factors. Yet currently, we're not trying to understand our customers holistically. We know that underwriting is a point-in-time assessment, and typically the underwriting effect will wear off over a 3 to 5 year period. In comparison, behavioural and lifestyle factors tend to be far more stable over the lifetime of a customer. So it would be worth considering increasing the use of these types of questions. Now, the following slides provide some examples of personal statement questions that are commonly asked for direct life products. We provide some of our observations on these questions, as well as suggesting ways in which they can be altered to better meet the needs of both the customer and the insurer. So let's start with question two, which is a seemingly simple question. What is your gender, male or female? Now, the fact is, in Australia, we do have a diverse population, some of whom do not identify as either strictly male or female. In light of this, we do believe it would be worthwhile to provide a third option, for example, gender neutral or other, as we saw used in the most recent Australian census. Question three. This asks customers if they've smoked tobacco in the last 12 months. While we know that smoker status is a key rating factor that is used to determine life insurance premiums, this question will not capture a history of smoking. Additionally, this question doesn't distinguish between heavy smoking and smoking socially, despite these representing very different risks. Perhaps a better way then to present this question would be to ask customers how many cigarettes they've smoked over, on average per week over a longer historical period, say 3 to 5 years, and to provide options for the customer to select from, for example, none, 1 to 10, and so forth. Question six. This asks customers if, on average, they drink more than 15 standard alcoholic drinks per week. Based on this, a loading may be applied. The current form of this question is quite binary and it permits a response of either yes or no. Again, as with the smoking question, we feel it would be better to use ranges for the customer to select from. Question seven. This asks customers whether in the last 5 years they have used any drugs other than those that are available over the counter. Anecdotal evidence suggests that there's very low disclosure for illicit drug use. The low disclosure for drug use raises the question, how good is our historical underwriting data, and are we really able to derive appropriate loadings based on the information that we currently have? In light of this, we feel it would be worth considering whether we need to keep this question within personal statements or at least consider where we place this within the overall list so that it doesn't rank as highly. Question 8. This asks customers if they've tested positive for HIV or AIDS or if they're awaiting the results of a test for HIV. If a customer were to answer yes to this question, an exclusion would apply to their policy. While we understand that this is a reasonable question to ask, it does relate to a risk that is far less prevalent in Australia today. The Australian Federation of AIDS Organisations suggests that AIDS diagnoses in Australia peaked in 1994 and have since rapidly declined, following the introduction of antiretroviral therapy. There are now only a handful of people diagnosed with AIDS in Australia each year. Based on this information, we were surprised by how high up in the overall list of questions this particular question is placed. And in fact, when we spoke to a number of industry practitioners, they were also surprised by how up it placed and the fact that it was still being asked. Question 9. This asks customers if they've had unprotected anal sex with more than one partner. This question is incredibly intrusive, and it's unclear how this information would be used as part of risk rating and premium setting. We would suggest removing this question from personal statements altogether. Questions 10 and 11. These ask customers if they've ever suffered from or sought medical treatment or medical advice for a whole host of medical conditions. These types of questions can be ambiguous, and they will often contain medical jargon, which makes them difficult for customers to answer. We also wonder whether it's reasonable for a customer to recall a condition for which they sought advice some 20, 30, or perhaps even a greater number of years ago. While we as actuaries understand that based on a customer's medical history, a product exclusion or loading may apply, to the average customer, they may not fully understand why their medical history is being asked and exactly how it will be used. An alternate way then to present these types of questions would be to be specific with regards to the types of conditions that are relevant to the product that's being purchased by the customer. In addition, we need to focus on severe questions and clearly articulate the time frame of relevance. The final question that we'll explore today asks customers if a family member under the age of 55 has been diagnosed with a major illness or condition. Again, this question may be ambiguous to a customer. It may not be clear to them what represents a major illness or condition. Additionally, some of our customers may not be in contact with their biological family. Again, an alternate way to present this question would be to be more specific with regards to the major illness or condition of relevance to the product. As an industry, we do feel that we also need to consider the implications of emerging trends such as the increasing use of IVF on underwriting questions relating to family history. So then, based on our assessment of the current state of direct life underwriting, we made four key observations which we set out for you here. One, industry practitioners do believe that there is evidence of underdisclosure by customers, in particular relating to alcohol, drug consumption, alcohol consumption, and mental health related issues. To give you an example, the Department of Health statistics state that 1 in 5 Australians between the ages of 16 and 85 would have experienced a mental health disorder in the last 12 months. In comparison, industry practitioners that we spoke to said that disclosure rates by customers for mental health were far lower. Customers understandably want to present themselves in the best possible light to their insurer. So how do we as an industry change the way in which we ask questions so that we can improve disclosure rates? One way in which we can do this is through the use of behavioural economics, which Liz will talk to shortly. Two, despite the large volumes of questions that we ask, a high percentage of lives will be rated as either standard smoker or standard non-smoker. While there is some variation by product type, industry practitioners tell us that this can be as high as 90%. So this raises the question, do we really need the full set of 30 to 45 questions that we're currently asking? Three, our current underwriting practices are not in line with the FSC Life Insurance Code of Practice. The code sets out for the need for transparency in decision making, use of plain language, as well as the need to take reasonable measures to provide additional support to customers that require this. For example, customers that are from a non-English speaking background. Lastly, there is a potential for a gap in customer expectations. Customers need to understand why certain information is being requested from them. Additionally, where cover is provided to them on altered terms or not at all, the reason behind this should be transparent to the customer. I'll now pass on to Liz, who will discuss some opportunities for improvement.
Thanks, Mira. So we took those examples from a number of products, and the more you look, the more examples you can find in other areas. Just last week, we were looking at voluntary cover in group insurance, and it was something along the something similar, except it was paper-based. And the first question of this personal statement was, have you ever suffered from high blood pressure or any other blood disease like leukemia? That was the first question. So the more you look, the more it is. And if you think of some of these questions, they're not actually targeted either to the age of the person that is applying for the cover. So needless to say, our young ones at work were asking, they're not that targeted, but the good news is that the technology and the rules engines and all the technology that companies are putting in really gives a great opportunity to rethink the way we're doing things, because you can have a smart engine that says this person is 25. I will not ask them, have you suffered, maybe your family, but have you suffered from dementia? I will not ask them that, and you can certainly be much more targeted. So I think it's good, and it's good that people, but what you see is even with this technology, people are just seem to have been putting in what they've always done. So, if it was so easy, why hasn't anyone done it? So I think one of the things is firstly, you've got external challenges, you've got legislation and regulation, and you must ask non-ambiguous questions, and then no one really wants to be the first mover, it would seem. So at the end we'll get some views on why does no one want to be the first mover. And then, of course, if you're in a company, there's a lot of internal challenges, there's a lot of internal competing priorities. So if you want to have expensive technology, although I think it's becoming cheaper, you need budget for that. And you do need the trade-off between the underwriting data and... So I heard an example in the last couple of weeks where the product people or the distribution people wanted 7 questions and the underwriting people were starting with about 60. So where do you find the, where do you find the gap, and then what about risk appetite? And so I think, as Mira pointed out, that this whole discussion between, and that's only internal to the companies. No one's actually asked the customer, but even between sales and distribution and product and underwriting and claims, sometimes there's not a lot of collaboration. It's the salespeople want something simpler. You know, the underwriting people are a bit nervous about giving away what they've always done. Because there's a loss of data because you've got all these questions filled in. But I think you'd question about how good your data actually is. And then if you look at the way we actually price business, and it's gender, male, female, age. So sometimes you have occupation. We'll get onto that. That's for income protection. But it's pretty basic. It's not like general insurance where you've got all these many rating factors which you can clearly see are linked to the questions that you're being asked when you apply for a policy. So I think work as actuaries, we've got work to do. And, you know, a call to action would be to go and speak to the people in underwriting and certainly in the people in claims. And it would be good. There's the time and cost associated with redesign. And here I'm only talking about direct. I'm not talking about the advised business. But I think if you could simplify some of the questions, it would also help in the advised business. Because it's also questionable if you need almost a medical degree to understand the question, does the advisor actually understand the question either? Because we're all consumers. Ourselves, the constraints of automation, but there's lots of opportunities, and there's great difficulty in measuring a customer's under-disclosure or non-disclosure. You can see cases of pure non-disclosure, but it's very hard to see under-disclosure. So we'll come back to it, but why does no company want to be the first mover in this space? Most companies need reinsurer support, and what are the reinsurers doing to help in this space? And another question is, who's actually tested anything with the customer? We couldn't really find anybody who tested anything with the customer. So there's some companies testing individual questions with behavioural economics, but no one's really tested their holistic process with the customer. So what are the opportunities for improvement? I think there's many. So we could start with the technical review of the questions. So I'll come explain a bit about behavioural economics, which I'm not an expert, but you know, the concepts that we could all apply. We could reorder the questions, the underwriting questions, and we could help to see what the key risks are for the price, for the product that we're offering, and help reorder the questions. And so Mira showed the HIV one, which is less prevalent. So in the 80s, it was very prevalent, and it was fair enough to have it high up there on the list, but now it's less prevalent, so it's really the main thing that you wanted to be asking. One chief medical officer said for IP, musculoskeletal, it's the main thing, and it's somewhere lost about question 20. So it's about rethinking what are we trying to rate and what are we going to do. So there's companies out there working on, you know, what they call the level one questions. What are the key things? If you could only ask 10 or 15 questions about a benefit type, what do you actually need to know? Mira showed the family history one. That's generally a catch-all question at the end. Did you talk about that? So, for example, yeah, so, you know, you could maybe ask the cancer. So there's certain family history of people, set aside the fact that you might not know your biological family, but if you did, there's certain, for certain conditions in the family which would make you a high risk and possibly exclude you from cover. But as a customer, you would probably want to know that early on in the process, not get to question 40 and then be taken out because of that. I saw one quite complicated thing. It had these conditions under 50, these ones under 60, these ones altogether. You could just make that wholly quite simpler, and not at the end, maybe at the start. So it's those sort of things, and I think out of that we'll get better risk rating. And what all of that means is you need the better cross-functional collaboration in companies between, especially, so claims people, you see claims where you wouldn't have paid those, and then you go back to the disclosure, and actually the question that was asked was not really in plain English, so the customer had innocent non-disclosure, but it wasn't really a claim that the company intended to pay. So there needs to be more of that. Just some thoughts that we had. And try to close the customer expectations gap so they know what they're covered for when they come to claim, and that there'll be less claims being denied on the basis of indirectly related or have you ever. When you ask someone, have you ever been to the doctor, most people here would be ever to been to the doctor. So I'll show you an example of a health company in the US which is doing something a bit different. So, customer-centric, actually pilot tests with actual consumers. We couldn't find anybody who'd tested the actual customer with actual real customers. And from our customer experience team, one of our experts told us that you can find out a lot with about 5 customers or 10 customers. You don't need to test 1,000 customers. Everything's in English. It doesn't cater at all for anybody who doesn't speak English. I mean, it's assumed they're going to read the PDS that's also in English. So somehow we need, with this good technology, we need to get more sophisticated. And there's no visuals. There's a company out there that's developing visuals for back injuries, which part of your back in claims that could equally be applied to some over time we think, and try to modernise the questions with these images just to make a better experience for the customer. Did one engagement and someone said, well, why can't I just like whip out my mobile phone and take a picture of my, you know, medical history and email, because that's what we do in general insurance. But sort of we've built, we can't do that because of privacy and medical things, but we often think that there's a lot of barriers that maybe we could solve. So market and product segmentation, I mean, if you're trying to sell a trauma product, what do you need to know? And that's probably different to IP. We saw another one where I think have you had psoriasis or saw any skin condition, it was for a death policy, and it was about question 8 or 10, right? It was right up there, and that's obviously not going to affect your mortality, but it's that sort of thing. I just need to rethink, we think. And some there's been a lot of talk about pre-existing conditions exclusions, and we just think related to this there could be a lot more transparency about that, how far it goes back, how far forward. A lot of definitions were directly or indirectly related. It's very hard for the customer to understand what they're covered for and what they're not covered for. So I think that's there's a lot of opportunities which are going to help the customer. So, and all these good new techniques are coming, so behavioural economics, so biopsychosocial, that's being used in IP to better manage claims. So why not underwriting? Why not ask more questions at the time of underwriting about those sort of things? As I've mentioned, the digital and technological capabilities are coming on strong, like there's engines and online applications, and you can have pop-up buttons with a little question mark, but the question mark explains the question. It doesn't really necessarily in some cases explain why we're asking, so we could use that technology. And then if you've got this data out of these engines, you can use machine learning to over time to ask smarter questions. So I think it just needs more will, and yes, it needs budget, but hopefully we'll get there and the technology will be cheaper and we'll have better outcomes. So behavioural economics, I know a number of companies and underwriters are looking at this because when you talk to people, they can't measure it, but that they know there's under-disclosure by customers about questions, especially on smoking, illicit drugs, although not clear what you're going to do with it, but smoking. If you compare the rates of, even if you asked a better question, you could get more people to disclose more like what the ABS statistics would tell you. So that's really about, social norms. There's another one about framing, like telling people that even if you answer, you should answer because in 85 or 90% of your cases, you're going to get standard rates and it's not going to affect your outcome. So that's another way to frame the question. Just placement. So we talked a lot about cutting down the length and the where you put the questions. And then disclosure, I mean, don't be afraid to put the eligibility conditions of the product up the front, because that's that, as an industry, that's what we are doing. We're saying you're only eligible in these circumstances. If you come to claim, this is going to be excluded, this and that. And if we want to exclude those things, we need to put that up the front, not at the back, or not certainly not at claims time, where the customer will have a possibly a expectations gap, as we could see some of the cases that were done in the report 498 that came from ASIC. So, you know, there's people out there. There's one doctor who's doing his PhD in this for IP. And I think underwriters are interested. They think there's a better way as well. So it's our job to help put all the pieces together, especially the ones designing and pricing the products. And I think as actuaries we have a lot to add. So we talked about plain English. So this is a company, their website is High Oscar. It's either Oscar or High Oscar. Does anybody know about this company? So it's a startup health company in the US, and it's now valued at $1 billion. So it's a different market, but the concept is, so they ask 5 questions basically to get your application. And I've used this as an example of towards sort of more plain English behavioural. Keep in mind, this is for health insurance. So if you imagine they're trying to work out, what's going to cause a risk of coverage. So the first thing is, I expect to see a specialist more than twice in the coming year. And there was some examples, drop-down boxes, cardiologist, So we could imagine, in the last 2 years or the last 5 years, have you seen a cardiologist as a question to talk about heart, right? And nobody will forget the fact that they went to the cardiologist. They might not know I had chest pain or whatever, which are some of the questions. But I think it's the next one, am I managing a chronic illness? If you've got a chronic illness, you'll know that that's what you've, and that you can have some examples. And it's just about, so the last one about I know it's, you would have to pay for these, this is why they're asking, but you can see if somebody's taking a lot of medication over time, perhaps there's something wrong with them, rather than the isolated case of antibiotics that you had. But a lot of questions are, have you been to the doctor in the last 5 years for anything other than the cold or the flu? Right, so you... So you'd have to write yes. Most people would have to write yes to that question, and then they'd be out or to the tele underwriter. So slowing down the process. So this is just an example of, and this company is very, very successful. So I think there's good examples out there in other industries and in other countries. So I hope that we can, move forward and adopt some of those. And I think, Mira's just going to summarise our thoughts, and then we'd like to have some questions and discussion, if it's okay.
So to summarise, it's time that we as an industry take the steps necessary to move direct life underwriting into the 21st century. We need to begin to consider how we can better meet the needs of our customers while making financially sound decisions. We know that younger customers in particular are becoming increasingly tech savvy, so we need to develop a technology-driven, user-focused underwriting experience that's simple, timely and transparent. To achieve this, as Liz mentioned, we need to be open to cross-functional collaboration, and we need to perform a review of the questions that we're asking with real customers. We need to refine our questions to be more targeted by product type and market segment, while continuing to explore the use of behavioural economics and biopsychosocial questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mira. Thank you, Liz. Probably in terms of the think differently theme, the thing that jumped out for me there was that whole way society is changing with family and gender and that sort of thing. The traditional underwriting questions are no longer valid or appropriate. But please, if anyone's got a question, please come on up to the microphone and ask your question, probably 5 minutes or so. So great to get some debate and some questions, please.
Dennis Wilkinson, and thank you very much for that presentation. I think it was a fascinating presentation. Throughout it, you emphasised the fact how little has changed over a number of years. And when you were going through all of those questions and going through the approaches still being taken, you have to say that although our approach to customers have changed, the questions and our approach to underwriting have not fundamentally changed. You mentioned general insurance, and general insurance has gone a lot further in doing more individual assessment of the actual risk. Within life insurance, we have the ability to do the same sort of thing. You've mentioned behavioural issues. You've talked about some of the biopsychological issues that are there. But we also have genetics. And I know it's a subject that we all get a bit twitchy about. But the reality is that over time, I suspect we will move away from a price that is based on gender and smoking and non-smoking to something that is far more risk-specific to the individual. We are seeing that we have got a lot of that information, but we're not using that in any form, and we're still trying to basically make people standard or non-standard and not going further than that. Do you believe that over time, underwriting of the future will actually take us more towards a genuine risk-based assessment of the individual risk of that person as opposed to just a broad-based assessment as we're using at the moment?
Yes, I think when you start with the technology, you can see, you can ask questions. If you ask them more targeted and the customer actually understood it, and then you would have that data and you start storing that data, then you would be able to reliably use that data for pricing. So I think in the direct products often come from, they actually come from the advisor product. So the company's got the retail advisor product, and then industry practitioners might share with me. It's like, so I think we have to really, and in the advisor space, if you move away from age, gender, then you're really the first mover in the advisor space, and non-smoker, smoker. So then you, as a company, it would be the first mover in that space with a different rate scale to everyone else. So maybe it's that why doesn't anyone want to be the first mover in the premium in the advisor space might be the question. But I know general insurance is different and they've got a lot more volume as well. But I think there's opportunity.
Greg Martin, Dennis, just maybe careful what you ask for. I think we've got a... Tom can tell you about the states which has preferred and super preferred life. You end up with a great bargain for half the community at half the price and an awful deal for the other half who can't actually change who they are. So you could shrink the market in half if you like. We get down to a $7 billion premium market, but I'm not sure whether that's a great idea. In parts of the world, they've actually stopped that sort of thing, like Europe, where you can't even rate now by gender. But just an observation. Be careful what you ask for.
Hi, I'm Leon from Covermore Travel Insurance. I don't have a life insurance background, but I'm really interested in your research in behavioural science. So I've been looking at a few insurers, and I think the ones with a very cognitively easy purchase path promotes disclosure as well, because the customers kind of like you guys, they trust you, so they're more willing to share. On the other hand, like I know back in the day, you used to have a claims form and have so much text and walls of text to basically deter claims. So I'm interested to understand more about the interaction between the two. So do we make something really, really easy, or do we make it hard to deter people from making a claim, like generally speaking?
I think life insurance underwriting is complex, and you don't, it's very hard to assess the risk, and you don't want to have people anti-selecting against you. So you have to ask a certain amount of questions. But what you also see we didn't really mention is there's sort of one size fits all for every product, so that it's not necessarily linked to the product. So I think where we're coming from is you have to link what product are you trying to offer. So I've seen products which has a mental health exclusion, the product, but up you're asking about have you ever had mental health, but you plan to exclude that when you come to pay the claim. So I think in our mind you should have the product. It should be much more linked, much more holistic. You should be trying to ask the questions that are very relevant to that product. You should have those I heard one client describe it as, I don't want any tricky stuff in my product, right? So that gets to eligibility. So you build that trust with the eligibility and you ask those questions up front. But so I think, and then some companies are actually getting, as they say, they're still studying, they get when a person actually speaks to the customer and they can ask more questions, they're getting better response rates and some over-disclosure. People tell them, there's some customers who are over-disclosing, telling everything they ever had for fear of their claim might be denied. So somewhere we need to find the balance. So I agree with you, there's the trust and there's, but let's be upfront and try to help the customer understand what we, and if we don't want to offer that product, we shouldn't offer it. I think Greg said, careful what you wish for. You can't get down to individual. It's not the way life insurance works. It's a group of customers, but on product, we certainly should be much clearer about what we're going to cover and what we're going to exclude and price accordingly for it. Does it answer your question?
Actually, I had a question for the audience. So for those of you who are from insurance companies, we'd like to hear from you how much cross-functional collaboration you think there is at the moment and what we can do to improve it going forward. Any takers?
Do you agree with the concept of testing more with customers? Real customers, or what stops us testing more with real customers? Is it fear? Is it, or is it just too far down the process to want to think of that? Or are you inspired to go and find out from some customers and find out what your company's doing? And I think it's good. There's only room for improvement. I mean, and as actuaries, we understand risk. We understand what we're trying to price. So I think we can help. We can help say, why are we asking this question? Well, we showed you, you know, like 15 drinks a week, so I drink 16 or I drink 14. What's going to happen? You know, like, I just wonder when we look at that, what are we doing with that in the pricing? Yeah. That's it.
Well, I think it sounds like those questions, Liz, have to be rhetorical questions and let people think it over and take it away with them. But I think it's almost time anyway. But can we get a big show of appreciation for our two speakers here, please?